From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The new film, Nurse Betty, is a comedy starring Renee Zellweger, Chris Rock, and Morgan Freeman. On today's Fresh Air, Henry Sheehan reviews the film, and we feature an interview from the archive with Morgan Freeman. The new movie, Psycho Beach Party, is adapted from a play by Charles Bush that spoofed Gidget and Beach Party movies. Bush starred in the play and is featured in the movie. We'll listen back to an interview in which he discussed how dressing in drag freed him as an actor. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new box set, Thelonious Monk, The Complete Prestige Recordings. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the new comedy Nurse Betty, the worlds of hitmen and soap operas collide through a young woman who is confusing fantasy and reality. The film was directed by Neil LaBute, who also wrote and directed the independent films In the Company of Men and Your Friends and Neighbors. Nurse Betty stars Renee Zellweger, Chris Rock, and Morgan Freeman. In a few minutes, we'll hear an interview from our archive with Morgan Freeman. First, film critic Henry Sheehan has a review of Nurse Betty.
Watching the movies of Neil LaBute, it's easy to forget he's a young filmmaker. LaBute constructs his films with a sure handling of cinema's raw material. It's only when you listen to LaBute's movies that you detect a youthfulness bordering on immaturity. Not that his dialogue is ever less than realistic when it has to be, or scalding when he wants it to be. But too often, his characters, though drawn with their share of suitably rationed out tics and traits, are just puppets. Their mouths open and out comes wretched hypocrisy, occasionally leavened with a dollop of putrid violence. In the Company of Men and Your Friends and Neighbors, LaBute was out to prove the moral unworthiness of a materialistic middle class, and he brooked no spontaneous outcry to the contrary. Nurse Betty is LaBute's latest and also the first movie for which he doesn't get a screenwriting credit. The script, by John C. Richards and James Flamberg, is fairly routine Hollywood stuff, a comic mixture of romantic fantasy and crime thriller. Renee Zellweger, in a beautiful performance, stars as a waitress in a small Kansas town who has an unusual fixation on a TV soap opera called A Reason to Love. Like most of the soap opera fans you meet in the movies, she herself lives in a cultural and romantic desert, saddled with an uncaring, unfaithful jerk of a husband named Dell, who is played by LaBute regular Aaron Eckhart. It's symptomatic of the screenplay's weakness that there is no earthly evidence of how Betty and Dell ever got together in the first place, or why they have stayed together. In the same contrived vein, Dell is visited by a couple of hitmen, played by Morgan Freeman and Chris Rock, because Dell has stolen some dope from their Kansas City bosses. Not knowing Betty is hiding in an adjoining room, the duo brutally murder Dell. Betty's poor, simple mind can't stand the trauma and so creates an alternate reality. Betty believes that A Reason to Love is real and that she is a character in it. Nurse Betty, the former fiancée of the soap's hero, handsome, caring Dr. David Revell. She hits the road on a cross-country pilgrimage to L.A. where she hopes to reunite with the one good man in her life. The killers, meanwhile, convinced she has the dope, are on her tracks. Having made it to Los Angeles, she looks for a job in a hospital where she thinks Dr. Revell works.
Of course, I don't know every doctor that works here.
But Dr. Revell is the finest surgeon on the staff. You must know him. He's really handsome, and he's gentle and considerate. He's being sued for sexual assault.
What?
Well, he didn't do it. He was set up.
Well, I certainly would have heard about that.
Of course, he's only here twice a week. He's also on staff over at Loma Vista.
I don't think I know that hospital.
Oh, it's the one in the really pretty area, with the palm trees out front and the mountains in the back.
You've just described all of Southern California. Well, I'm sorry, but I can't even consider you without references and a resume. And frankly, I don't know how you could have forgotten them.
Quickly, we note that Betty is only one of several characters living under albeit less dramatic illusions. Chief among them is Freeman's hitman, Charlie, a philosophical killer on his last job who becomes mistakenly convinced that Betty is some sort of apotheosis, an epitome of grace and intelligence who will be a worthy top-off to an infamous career. The sour observation that a pathological delusion is different only in degree from the normal misperceptions of humanity is right up LeBute's creative alley. People who seem nice are creeps. People who look like creeps are creepier. The movie's liveliest sequence is one that seems pure LeBute, Dell's murder, which follows a verbal tongue-lashing by the erudite Charlie. It's spiritual damnation followed by physical mortification, a LeBute double dip. But movies sometimes slip the bonds of even their most dictatorial creators. Nurse Betty plays surprisingly well because of the solid cast, and in particular Zellweger. Seemingly an actor of pure ingenuousness, she has a gift for making us give a character a second or third look, at delivering lines so that we don't listen and move on, but store them for future comparisons. Zellweger's sure, gentle hands release Betty from LeBute's straitjacket.
Henry Sheehan is film critic for the Orange County Register. On this archive edition, we have an interview with one of the stars of Nurse Betty, Morgan Freeman. His other films include Seven, Glory, Driving Miss Daisy, and Unforgiven. Critics and audiences agree that he's a great actor, but he didn't have a major screen role until 1980 when he was 50 years old. The film was Street Smart. Pauline Kael began her review of the movie by asking the question, "Is Morgan Freeman the greatest American actor?" A lot of other people seem to be asking the same question. I spoke with Morgan Freeman in 1993.
I want to ask you about the film that I think first brought you a lot of attention. And I'm thinking of Street Smart, and it's a film, you know, unlike Glory, it's not a film about an important freedom struggle. It's a film about a pimp and a prostitute and a journalist who writes a phony story. You played the pimp in the movie. You know, a lot of African-American actors really feel sick that so many parts that have been available for the past couple of decades have been pimp roles. You transformed this pimp role into just an extraordinary performance. Did you realize that the part had the potential to be something really special when you read it?
I guess that's the way you do it. You know, you read a script and you're looking at the character that you're going to be playing and thinking how much difficulty or fun it's going to be. And when I read this, this guy was really fun for an actor because he was mercurial, you know? A character that you can play who has all these different shadings to go through, that's the actor's forte. That's his métier. That's what he wants to get into, and that's where you can chew, you know?
Can you give us a sense of what you felt you could do to make sure that this wasn't just a central casting type pimp role? You know what I mean? Like when you thought about the role and what you wanted to do?
Well, after they told me I was going to be doing the role, I spoke to the costume designer, Joe Innocenzo. And I said, I don't want anything like crushed velvet or big collars or high hues. Or no, I want Saks Fifth Avenue.
Well, why?
Huh?
Why did you want Saks and not Superfly?
Because I didn't want to play this kind of stereotyped guy. I once met a pimp in Chicago, and he was, he might not have been a pimp, I'll take that back, but he was definitely a well-connected procurer. Okay, and I thought, now this is the guy, this is the character you want, you know, guy who looks good, dresses well, presents himself well, is laid back, mixes in any crowd, and has a power. There's an aura around him that turns everybody on.
No, also in your role, you had this incredible viciousness that would just come out from out of nowhere, and it would be real scary when it did. I mean, there's this great scene where Kathy Baker, who plays a prostitute, where you think, yeah, and you think that she's betrayed you, so you take a knife and you tell her
scissors.
What? Scissors. I'm sorry, it's a scissors. That's right. And you tell her,
I'm going to take one of your eyes.
Yeah.
You just tell me which one you want to lose. Yeah.
And then you say the right, the
or
left?
The left. Which? Yeah. And, you know, the power of that scene is the fact that Kathy believed me. So she was she was having to deal with making that choice. It was an extraordinary scene, but it was primarily because you were watching this woman's reaction. Yeah.
We'll get back to our 1993 interview with Morgan Freeman after a break. This is Fresh Air. Actor and director Morgan Freeman is my guest. I'm interested in your background. You were born in Memphis, grew up in Mississippi for the first few years of your life.
Yeah.
Raised until you were six by your grandmother.
My paternal grandmother, yeah.
Your paternal grandmother. Yeah. Where were your parents?
They were in Chicago. And when my paternal grandmother died, my biological father came down and got me and my sister. I have two brothers who were living with my maternal grandmother at the time. Mm. So, you know, we all wound up in Chicago there for a short while.
So when you went to live with your mother in Chicago, did you feel welcome? Did you feel that she wanted you?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that was that was life as it should be. Yeah.
Had she not had the money to raise you before? Or?
Well, you know, my whole background all the way back as far as I can count is Mississippi. And going from Mississippi to Chicago, Detroit, New York, you name whatever urban center migrants go to, you get in on the bottom rung. Mm-hmm. So it's better not to be burdened with your young if you can leave them home and safe in some place, you know?
So what was it like for you when you got to Chicago?
Dreadful. Just awful. It was the middle of the winter. I was not prepared in any kind of way to deal with. I mean, I came from Charleston, Mississippi. I mean, a little town where everybody, you know, the Africans have a saying, it takes a whole village to raise a child.
Yeah.
Well, I came from a situation where the whole village was raising me. And I wound up in a place where people don't even speak and they live in the same building. So it was a wrench. It was awful for a kid 6 years old and, you know, protected all his life.
Was it a very tough neighborhood?
Tough neighborhood. Couldn't go out, got on the street, couldn't get to school. I went to school and quit after about a week.
Because you were afraid?
Oh, it was too awful. You had to run a gauntlet just to get from home. At the time, I lived a block from school. I couldn't make it.
So how'd you learn to defend yourself?
Well, after a period of time, you know, you see the do or die. You know, you can't just stay locked up in the house. You got to go out and face it, you know. And it's an amazing thing, too. You know, as a kid, you go out and you face the ones who grabbed you and threw you down and stuffed snow down your clothes or beat you up and sent you home. You come back out and you face them and they all laugh, you know.
Were you really tall as a kid?
No, I was very small and skinny. And
I can't imagine you short.
Well, don't think short. Think skinny.
Right. Okay, I can imagine you skinny. That's easy.
Yeah. I was very bookish, you know, and I read all the time. And was one of those strange kids.
What did you like to read?
Everything. Didn't really matter. If it was a book, I read it. I read Black Beauty, my first book, when I was 8 years old. You know, I'm a hardback book instead of a comic book.
Is reading bad for your image if you have to try to prove that you can defend yourself and that you could be...
No. Reading is never bad for your image on any level at all. What's bad for your image is not being able to stand up and fight in a situation, you know. Mm-hmm. That's really bad for your image.
Right.
Particularly in any urban setting, you know. Or I suppose any place. You got to be able to defend yourself on some level or other.
So did you join a gang or anything?
Oh, yeah. When some point we moved and up to 45th and South Parkway, and I had to, well, you do that for self-protection, you know. If you're on this turf, you're in this gang, and then you can move around. But if you go to another set of, you know, the other section of town, then woe be unto you.
Did you ever get into the kind of trouble that could have ruined your life?
Well, I was certainly headed for it. Being in these little gangs and things, you have to sort of prove yourself to someone. Generally, someone who calls himself a leader, you know. So I remember once I stole a guy's bicycle from in front of a store. You know, the other guy said, "We'll wait here. You go get the bicycle, and you meet us around the corner." All right, fine. And I went and I got the bicycle, and of course, the guy came out of the store and saw me on the street with his bicycle, snatched it away from me, grabbed me by the collar, and gave me one slap, and it just happened that a grown-up was coming by at the time and told him to leave me alone. I got free of that and was gone. But, you know, the lesson in this is I'm going to do wrong. I'm going to get caught.
Mm-hmm.
So I managed somehow or other to avoid a lot of the trouble that I should have gotten into being with this gang, because I knew that if I did it, they were going to catch me and I was going to pay.
Right. Now, you went into the Air Force.
Air Force, yeah.
Did you think about going to college?
I thought about it for a hot minute. I was in Mississippi at the time, and I knew that. I was sort of, you would call me a big fish in a little barrel at the time, because I had a good acting reputation out of high school, and I was offered partial scholarships in dramatics to go to Jackson State or Tougaloo. But I was really tired of school. I really wanted to get out and do some living, you know, and have some adventures and be a fighter pilot, you know, do all the stuff I'd seen in the movies.
Did the Air Force give you what you were hoping for?
No. It gave me what I needed, but not what I thought I was hoping for.
So what did you need and what were you hoping for?
I thought I was hoping for a white scarf and...
I've seen that movie.
Right. And wings. An F-86 jet all my own, you know. But what it gave me was a sense of confidence and discipline and an entree to the world, you know, that sort of segue from dependency on community and school and family to being able to stand on my own and really come out and meet the world. And it also got me from Mississippi to Hollywood.
How did it get you to Hollywood?
Well, when I was discharged, I was in San Bernardino.
Oh.
It's a short hop, skip, and a jump, you know, a 45, 50-minute bus ride.
Now, how did you start auditioning or getting more training or whatever when you got to Hollywood?
Well, my first thought was, I've got to get somewhere. I got to go and get a job, you know. So I went to Paramount offices up on Sunset Boulevard, and I walked in and sat down. You know, my name is Morgan Freeman, and I'm an actor, and I'm looking for work. And the lady gave me this card to fill out and said, you know, what kind of office machines do you operate, and how many words do you type a minute,
right,
et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and what's your job history? And I just graduated. I just got discharged from the service, and I don't do any of this kind of work. I'm an actor. Well, I didn't go far. I didn't get very far. And I never did really get to auditions and things like that in Hollywood. I left Los Angeles and went to New York.
And worked on the stage?
No. I just came to New York to see if I couldn't find work on the stage and all. You know, you come out from nowhere and you don't know how to, where to, who to. You just keep running after, you know, partially closed doors. You see somebody disappear through a door, you go running after them and the door closes. Just as you get there. That sort of always happened. I went to the Negro Actors Guild on 42nd Street, and I climbed up these steps, and there was this guy sitting there, and there were all these sort of faded posters and things, and the whole thing could tell you that nothing's going on here. Nothing. You don't know about agents, you don't know about casting agents, you don't know how to, so you get a job, you know. I got a job as a telegrapher, and I stayed there until February, in the dead of winter, and then I decided to leave and went to San Francisco because I was going to leave the country ultimately and go to Paris, heck with it.
Mm-hmm.
But I hadn't seen San Francisco, and so I went to San Francisco. And managed, after a few months, to wind up in a little theater repertory company there. And that was my beginning. And from that, I got into dance. I started dancing and taking dance classes and stuff. And I stayed there until 1963 and left in September. And I came back to New York as a dancer.
What kind of dance? Broadway?
Yeah, right. Ballet. Jazz, tap, all the stuff that Broadway dancers have to take.
Mm-hmm.
But that was my intro into the theater, because the most incredible and effective networking is among dancers.
Do you think that there are any advantages and disadvantages of having really made it as an actor, of really getting the kudos and the attention and the roles when you reach the age of 50, as opposed to when you were still in your 20s,
I think if I had really hit it in my 20s, I would have burned out. I would have drugged myself right into oblivion. You know, I don't think I would have had enough discipline, enough smarts to control it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you start making money and getting a lot of press, I think you need either someone around you who has a head much leveler than yours, or you need some agent experience, you know, something to make you know that this is all really here today and gone tomorrow. You know, it's transitory.
Morgan Freeman, I thank you so much for talking with us.
Terry, it's a pleasure.
Morgan Freeman recorded in 1993. He's one of the stars of the new film, Nurse Betty. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, from Learning Network, providing education-based tools and tips for parents, teachers, and students, online at familyeducation.com, and from M-Power Communications, offering integrated telephone and data services to small and mid-sized businesses. Information available at nowyouhavethepower.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, an actor who has great legs and isn't afraid to use them. We talk with drag star Charles Bush. His off-Broadway comedy Psycho Beach Party has been adapted into a new film. And Kevin Whitehead reviews Thelonious Monk, the complete Prestige recordings. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Charles Bush discovered who he was as an actor when he became a leading lady and put on lashes and heels. He's written and starred in gender-bending plays that are both tributes to and send-ups of Hollywood. His Vampire Lesbians of Sodom was the longest-running play in off-Broadway history. The lady in question was a melodrama set in the 40s. In the New York Times, Frank Rich described Bush's performance as a walking anthology of feminine Hollywood legends. Bush was featured in the HBO prison series Oz as a gay inmate. Now his play, Psycho Beach Party, has been adapted into a new film, spoofing Gidget and Beach Party movies. In the original stage version, Bush starred as a teenage girl who wants to be a surfer but suffers from multiple personality disorder. Bush wrote the film adaptation and is featured as a woman cop investigating a murder at the local drive-in.
Captain Monica Stark, L.A. Sheriff's Department.
Detective Mulaski.
Now don't tell me. Florence Burdine.
Wow, you're good.
It's my job. I understand you both were at the drive-in last night.
Oh, yeah, Burdine's the gal who found the body.
I want to know exactly what you heard and exactly what you saw.
Well, it's hard because I was concentrating on the subtext of the film.
What about you, Florence?
Well, I guess I was coming back from the snack bar.
Did you notice anything unusual? Anything at all?
Well, to be honest with you, the whole night's something of a blur. I did some rat thing, spiked my orangeade.
Hello, girls.
Hi, Mom.
Florence, hop in. I thought you were going to help me pickle those beets.
Oh, I was just on my way. I got a skedaddle. Toodles.
We haven't quite finished.
May I ask what's going on here?
There was a murder at the drive-in last night. White female, 17, sleeping it off in the morgue.
A murder? And you didn't tell me?
I didn't want to upset you.
What were you doing around 9 p.m., Mrs. Forrest?
What any woman should be doing at that hour. Needlepoint.
I spoke with Charles Bush in 1993 when he was starring in a cabaret revue in which he got to dress in glittery evening gowns. What do you think the difference is between what you're doing on stage and what more traditional female impersonators have done? The female impersonators who specialize in Betty Davis and Judy Garland, Barbara Streisand. Mm-hmm.
Well, because they are doing specific people, and I do different characters that are sort of my own invention, although sometimes I kind of
do a little Judy.
or if I'm doing like one point in the show, I do this old movie sketch, and I kind of slip into a little Betty Davis at times just to kind of punctuate the line, or a little Susan Hayward. But it's basically my own character, I like to think.
But it also seems to me that you're more consciously gender bending than a lot of your predecessors.
Yeah. But I sort of straddle the fence in many ways. It seems that you can sort of divide female impersonators into two groups. Generally, those who are comedians and are pretty, kind of outrageous looking and somewhat maybe even grotesque, but are very funny. And then there are other female impersonators who go to great lengths to create this perfect illusion of beautiful femininity. And often they kind of lip sync to songs but I'm sort of in the middle. Because I'm a comedian, but I look kind of good in those gowns. My legs ain't bad, So I think, so I'm sort of in the middle. And I must say, too, I've lost any bit of integrity I may have had. Or I used to go to great pains where when I would do shows that I never wore falsies, that I wasn't really trying to convince the audience of an illusion. I was just kind of giving the notion of a general idea, but I don't know. Maybe it's just I've gotten older, but I'm so padded up. I think I've got two editions of the Sunday Times in each hip, my God, I go to great pains now to look very lovely. So, I'm very careful about the lighting. So I don't know what that is. Maybe it's just the more you do it, the more you kind of get into it.
Some drag queens object to feminism because it's not feminine enough, and really some drag queens really believe in traditional gender roles.
Yeah, I would think so. Isn't it interesting? And yet, I guess, I was raised in a largely female household with two sisters that I'm very close to, and so the issues of feminism have always been rather real to me. And so I've always kind of prided myself that the female characters in my plays are sort of feminist role models. I always sort of played the career woman, you know, battling that devil man who's you can't trust him. You know, so I've kind of liked it, and I, you know, I have. Seems like I've female following. You know, I think there's, you know, always going to be somebody who's upset by something you do, and I'm sure, you know, some women might just find the whole notion of drag just offensive, and no matter what you do, you know, even if I did the Kate Millett story, they wouldn't like it, you know. But I, in my heart, I know that I respect women, and I love the whole, the kind of women that I admire so are such strong women.
For our listeners who haven't seen your shows, let me ask you to say a couple of words about a couple of your shows.
Okay.
Let's start with Vampire Lesbians of Sodom.
This Those are four big words. Strong words.
And, well, you know, not the of.
And, but we had, you know, a hard time, you know, when that show first started in 80, we started in 84, we moved it commercially in 85, and the New York Times wouldn't print the name in the ad.
Really?
Yeah, and I wondered, I thought, you know, gee, it must be... I think if the play was called The Lesbian, they would have printed it, or if it was called Vampires, or even if it was called Sodom, but you put them together and, oh boy, you know, head for the hills.
So tell us what it was about.
Well, it was kind of like a series of vaudeville sketches more than a play, and I played a lovely virgin sacrifice in ancient Sodom who is bit by the very glamorous succubus creature, this kind of Mae Westian... vampirus, and she, the virgin sacrifice, because of this bite, becomes a vampire too, and so the two of them are kind of in a race across time as they go through various centuries trying to steal each other's thunder, and kind of the joke of it was that they were both, after they left Sodom, they both were in show business, and so we saw them in Hollywood in the 20s where they're vamps and silent films, and then in Las Vegas today and they're still at it. So it was, you know, it was a cute show. And what I liked about it too is that underneath all the very silly campiness, it kind of, I thought it had a little something to say about relationships. And I think that many of us have friends or even, you know, relatives who could just drive us crazy and you'd like to murder at times. But if they weren't around, we'd certainly miss them.
Well, what was the very first time you dressed in drag?
Let's see. Well, I think when I was about 9, I think Bobby Fitzpatrick next door wanted us to put on his mother's evening gown. But other than that, it was many years later. I was in college and just dressing up for Halloween. But I learned really right away. It occurred to me that I got kind of bored when I just put on the dress and makeup and everything got all rigged up. Just as an end to itself, it just... I got kind of restless and sort of tired, too. You just kind of want to spread your legs and, you know, and relax, you know. And I needed to have the role. It's, for me, drag is so connected with the theater that I can't separate it. That as soon as I... like for instance, we had a float in the gay parade, and I put together this outfit to... I mixed and matched. And but this, at this point, I certainly can. I've got probably more clothes than you have. I mean, I've a lot of... dresses for every occasion, you know, if you need
I'm
anything.
Sure you have more heels than I do.
Yeah, well, call me, you know. And anyway, so I put together this outfit to wear, just to wear, you know, in this open car. And as soon as I put it on, though, my mind was just racing so quickly. I was suddenly I was Melina McCrory in Never on Sunday. 5 seconds later, no, I'm Audrey Hepburn in a 60s caper film. Oh no! And it was so dizzying that I finally was just getting like hyperventilating just because of the images in my head of the different roles that I could play in that costume. So it wasn't enough just to be, you know, don't I look swell in this lovely couture creation.
You know, it's really funny. I feel like I should ask you for tips about how to walk in high heels. I've never been able to wear heels.
Really? It's so simple.
Not that I'm dying to wear them or anything, but my feet ache and I figure it's not worth it. So you want to give me some tips?
Oh, I could run the decathlon in it. I could. You know, talk about drag racing. I mean, I could really. I walk better in heels, I think, than in flats somehow. I've fallen arches, kind of. I think the heels help me. But I must say, after a number of hours, it's agony. I had this part in the sequel to The Addams Family. I play their cousin, the Countess Aphasia Addams-Dubarry, and I was in high heels for 17 hours on a movie set, and that was rather horrifying, you know. But for a couple hours, I don't know, you just sort of balance yourself, and I took to it like a duck to water. You know, I never quite understood when you see movies like Tootsie where the guys get in heels and they're wobbling all over the place. And I know, I guess it's for comic effect, but I never found it so tricky.
Actor and writer Charles Bush is my guest. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1993 interview with drag performer Charles Bush. His play Psycho Beach Party has been adapted into a new movie.
Did dressing in drag or doing theater in drag coincide at all with figuring out your sexual identity?
In a certain sense, it did. In just that, when I was in college, I was coming out gay, and I came out gay with a sledgehammer. I mean, I was just, awful, just outrageous. My best friend and I, and we just, it was sort of during the height of the David Bowie sort of, glitter rock period. We had red hair and, eyeliner on, and I had this awful big fur coat on. I thought I looked like Maria Schneider in Les Tango of Paris, but I don't know if everyone else shared that opinion. But anyway, at the same time, I'm taking these acting classes, and the roles that you would work on in class would be like, Bo and Bus Stop or Biff and Death of a Salesman, and I just did not identify at all. And there just were there are no roles that are anything, and particularly like in college we would be it was kind of a method sort of, Stanislavski approach where you're supposed to be using elements of your own, past and your emotions, and it was very hard for me to identify. And so, consequently, there were, no roles that I even wanted to play. And I was really tormented because I was obsessed with acting and all my life wanted to be an actor. And I thought, if there are no roles in the repertoire that I am desperate to play, what's the point, And I thought, I could be the boy in Equus, but there are many other fellas who could play it a lot better or just as well. I wanted to be special. I wanted to be unique. And I always wrote, and then I was always kind of improvising different characters for my friends. And I had a friend who said, "Well, this is who you are. This is what you should do." And it took me a while to really realize that was the case, and that what I really loved was writing the story and telling it myself.
Did you actually make it onto the stage in roles that you didn't identify with when you were trying to?
I didn't. I usually never got them. Uh-huh. I usually wasn't cast because someone else who was more comfortable with it. I was uncomfortable with my masculinity. And in a way, I think now, after all these years doing drag, for some reason now I feel just more at ease with myself and ready to go from leading lady to juvenile. Rather a leap, isn't it? A unique one. And also, I tell you the truth, there's so much drag around nowadays. I like to think that maybe I helped pave the way. Of course, was helped by Charles Ludlam and Harvey Firestein, and people went on before me. But I think the success of Vampire Lesbians, ran 5 years, and I think that certainly encouraged people to, think of camp and drag as being a commercial possibility.
Do you think it's easier for you? You said you're more comfortable with your masculinity now. I mean, you've been able to define what that is. It's not getting defined for you by the outside anymore.
I guess so. And for me, drag and assuming a female persona is not such a big deal. I know there are great differences between the sexes, but in many ways there aren't. And at least for me, I guess I have a slightly androgynous nature, and for me to go from male to female is sometimes just a question of how I cross my legs.
Now, your father, I understand, listened to a lot of opera. And did he sell opera records?
No, my father, well, he had a record store, it's true. And I guess he did sell some opera records, although I think of him mostly having, rock and roll. But His store was in Yonkers, so it wasn't really an opera haven. But he wanted to be a singer. And so he performed with different sort of semi-professional and amateur opera companies in Westchester, where I was growing up. And so my bedtime stories were the plots of Verdi and Puccini operas. And sort of the first theater I saw were these productions that he would be in, where everything, including the chorus, were painted on the backdrop. And I just was enraptured by it. And I think that whole idea of sort of cheap theatricality stayed with me, and certainly you can see it in my plays.
Yeah, that's certainly the larger-than-life type of play.
Yeah, I love melodrama so much, and even as much as I love the comedy. And so my plays are often, you know, sort of revenge dramas, and if you took away the element of parody or the, you know, the shtick or the comedy, you know, the stories themselves are stories of passion and revenge and, you know, good triumphing, and there's often, you know, somebody there is jumps out a window or is being murdered. I think somebody's been murdered in just about every play I've written. It's kind of odd, you know, in their comedies. So I think that really shows that earliest interest was in melodrama.
So while your father was feeding you these stories of the great operas and thus kind of nourishing your interest in melodrama.
I had a very romantic sensibility. That was, by the time I'd say I was seven, my entire, everything that I'm interested in today was set.
But I bet your father was not very encouraging of your interest in acting out the parts of great actresses.
Oh, yeah, no, pas nécessaire.
No,
my father was so stage-struck.
Oh, really?
So stage-struck that I really could have done anything, and he would have been approved. And, I mean, just, I think when he sees my name on a marquee, I think he can sort of blot out the first name and imagine it's his own. I mean, he kind of lives vicariously through me, and I don't mind it at all, you know. So he lives in Florida now, but when he comes to see me in a show and, you know, I bring him backstage and he walks out on the stage, I can see him just sort of inhaling it in. He just loves it. And so he's seen all my shows, and that doesn't bother him at all.
Charles Bush, recorded in 1993. Bush wrote the screen adaptation of his play Psycho Beach Party. He's featured in this new movie as a woman cop. Dion has a new CD of new songs, several of which are reminiscent of his doo-wop days with Dion and the Belmonts. Yesterday, he brought his guitar to our studio and did some terrific performances. We'll hear that session later this month. In the meantime, let's hear a track from his new CD, Deja Nu. This is one of two songs on it that were written by Bruce Springsteen.
We said we'd walk together, baby, come with me. That come the twilight, should we lose our way? If as we were walking, our hands should slip free, I'll wait for you. Should I fall behind, wait for me. We swore that we would travel, darling, side by side. And we'd help each other to stay in stride. But each lover's step falls so differently. Girl, I'll wait for you. If I should fall behind, wait for me.
Music from Dion's new CD, Deja Nu, will feature an interview and performance with him later this month. Coming up, a review of a new Thelonious Monk box set. This is Fresh Air.
We'll be right back.
Jazz pianist and composer Thelonious Monk made a set of brilliant recordings for the Blue Note label in the late 1940s and early 50s. He made another set of classic records for the Riverside label starting in 1955. In between, he cut a few sessions for Prestige Records. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says the Prestige sides aren't quite as strong as what Monk recorded just before or after, but they're worth your attention anyway. Kevin reviews a new collection of those sides.
Nowadays, Thelonious Monk is on everyone's list of jazz greats, and has been since he died in 1982. When he was alive, though, some jazz musicians and listeners didn't get him at all. They might concede he'd written a few good tunes, notably the ballad Round Midnight, which Monk himself had grown tired of. But his piano playing left them thinking he was all thumbs. In a way, you couldn't blame them. Monk played the most advanced harmonies any jazz musician ever concocted. But he loved to make them sound like the fumbling of an amateur pianist wearing mittens. It was as if Monk put forth his piano playing as an ear training exercise and test case for listeners. Whether you heard it as brilliant or bold said more about you than him. He cultivated the clunkiness that stemmed from his cluster-like chords and hesitating rhythm. For evidence, listen to him on his first studio session in 1944, led by his early booster, saxophonist Coleman Hawkins. Back then, Monk sounded more conventional than he did a few years later. This music comes from a new 3-CD set of recordings Monk made for the Prestige label between 1952 and 54. Also included is that earlier Coleman Hawkins session, not recorded for Prestige, but never mind, and a 1954 date led by Miles Davis. As every Monk fan knows, the trumpeter asked the pianist not to play behind his solos on that occasion. The side folk on Monk's own trio, quartet, and quintet sessions include Frank Foster and the young Sonny Rollins on tenor saxophone, Monk's ideal accompanist, Art Blakey, on drums, and the pioneering jazz French horn soloist, Julius Watkins. He was hastily added to one date when a trumpeter failed to show up. Prestige recordings were all available on CD already and scattershot volumes, but it's good to have them collected in an orderly fashion. That said, you might fairly object to yet another box set including that Miles Davis date. Monk's Prestige sides are not as groundbreaking as his earlier Blue Note stuff, nor as varied or well-recorded as his Riverside LPs just ahead. But they do contain first recordings of some of his classics, including Blue Monk, Baya, and this one, Trinkle Tinkle, where Monk's harmonies are made even more piquant by an out-of-tune piano. The drummer is Max Roach. The vocalist is Monk. Throughout his career, Thelonious Monk avoided easy solutions, and he often paid for it with a lack of commercial success, which was chronic during his prestige years. Monk's case reminds us that art which seems difficult at first can yield the greatest pleasures in the long run. As Monk himself said in 1959, "Don't play what the public wants. Play what you want and let the public pick up on what you're doing, even if it does take them 15 or 20 years." That prophecy was almost exactly on the mark. 23 years later, he was a posthumous hero.
Kevin Whitehead reviewed Thelonious Monk, The Complete Prestige Recordings. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From the Buffalo Niagara Enterprise, coordinating efforts between local economic development agencies and companies interested in the Buffalo Niagara region, buffaloniagara.org. From Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. And from Random House Incorporated's Bantam Books Division, publisher of the novel The Man Who Ate the 747 by Ben Sherwood. This is NPR, National Public Radio.